Today is Thursday, November 23rd, and this is the World Socialist Website. Israel's Gaza truce. A pause to reload the guns for the next stage in the genocide against the Palestinians. By Jordan Shilton. The brief lull in Israel's savage onslaught on the defenseless civilian population of Gaza, scheduled to begin at 10 a.m. local time Thursday, is widely being presented as a ceasefire, or at least a humanitarian pause. Assuming the agreement is fulfilled, which is by no means assured, it will amount to little more than an operational pause in Israel's military offensive to ethnically cleanse Gaza by carrying out a genocide against the Palestinian people. The terms of the agreement, mediated by Qatar in the United States, include the release by Hamas of 50 women and children among the approximately 240 Israelis captured by Hamas fighters during the October 7th incursion into Israel. In return, Israel will release 150 Palestinian detainees, halt fighting in the Gaza Strip for 4 days, and permit 200 trucks carrying aid to enter the enclave each day. The number of Palestinian detainees being released is minuscule compared to the over 10,000 Palestinians held in detention by Israel under the most brutal conditions, including routine torture. The agreement remains highly unstable, illustrated by the announcement late Wednesday by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's National Security Advisor, that the release of the first hostages would be delayed by up to 24 hours and only take place Friday. During the four-day pause, Israel will refrain from operating aircraft and drones over southern Gaza, but in the north they will only do so during a short window between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. each day. All Israeli ground forces will remain in place, ready to resume battle at a moment's notice. As Netanyahu put it at a press conference Wednesday evening, quote, "When the pause is done, we resume the war. It may be that we are forced to do so much earlier," unquote. He also rejected any suggestion that the pause applied on Israel's northern border, where the Israel Defense Forces, or IDF, has been striking Hezbollah targets in southern Lebanon. Underlining the point, War Cabinet Minister Benny Gantz told the same press conference, quote, "What's happening now in northern Gaza can also happen in southern Lebanon and Beirut," unquote. Even if the pause in fighting holds, it will strengthen Israel's military position. Some military analysts have claimed that since Israel has used about 2,500 Joint Direct Attack Munition smart bomb kits in Gaza since the bombardment began 6 weeks ago, it only retains stockpiles of precision-guided munitions for 10 days of fighting. With daily C-17 flights arriving in Israel from the U.S. Ramstein Air Base in Germany carrying much-needed military supplies, the four-day period could give the IDF time to replenish its stocks. The military situation on the ground could also allow Israel to use the pause to prepare the next stage in its genocidal onslaught. As the Wall Street Journal wrote in a Wednesday editorial, the timing of the agreement, quote, "isn't bad for Israel. Having assumed a dominant position in Gaza's north, it needs to prepare to turn south," unquote. The crisis-ridden Netanyahu government is far less enthusiastic about the agreement. Netanyahu has repeatedly stressed that his main goal in the Gaza war is to eliminate or destroy Hamas, meaning in reality the expulsion of the Palestinians from Gaza. Jewish Power, Netanyahu's fascistic coalition partner, voted to reject the hostage deal at a Tuesday night cabinet meeting. However, Netanyahu came under increased pressure from the families of the hostages over recent days to do more to secure their release. Netanyahu is a deeply unpopular figure in Israel, with broad sections of the population holding him at least partially responsible for the deaths of Israeli civilians on October 7th. His increasingly precarious position makes it all the more likely that he will endeavor to resume and intensify the war at all costs, since the alternative would almost certainly be the end of his premiership, followed by criminal prosecution. In the 6 weeks since Israel's air bombardment began, well over 14,000 Palestinian civilians have been killed, and half of Gaza's buildings have been destroyed or damaged. Just 10 of Gaza's 36 hospitals are functioning. Al-Shifa Hospital, formerly the enclave's largest, has been occupied by Israeli troops, with parts of it turned into a military barracks. Malnutrition and disease are rampant among the population due to the deliberate targeting of bakeries, which have all stopped operating, and lack of fuel to power water treatment facilities. Oblivious to this human catastrophe, the corporate-controlled media would have everyone believe that the Biden administration twisted Netanyahu's arm and intervened in the negotiations with Qatar to secure a humanitarian pause. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders wrote in an opinion piece for the New York Times that the pause is a, quote, promising first step that we can build upon, unquote. Sanders, who just 2 weeks ago rejected any talk of a ceasefire out of hand, proceeded to call for a, quote, significant extended humanitarian pause, unquote, and work towards a, quote, unquote, two-state solution, all of which could be achieved, quote, if the United States uses the substantial leverage we have with Israel, unquote. The suggestion that U.S. imperialism, after more than 3 decades of uninterrupted wars in the Middle East, Central Asia, and North Africa, acts as some sort of moderating influence on the Israeli regime is preposterous. Throughout the entire 6-week bombardment of Gaza, the unconditional support of Washington and its European imperialist allies for the Israeli military has emboldened the Netanyahu government to carry out war crimes on a daily basis. These have included the devastation of hospitals, schools, and critical public infrastructure, the killing of over 100 United Nations aid workers, and the cutting off of electricity, fuel, and water to Gaza's 2.3 million residents. As for the two-state solution, the Israeli regime has openly declared its genocidal intentions against the Palestinians, with Biden administration officials proclaiming all the while that they would not impose any red lines on Israel's conduct of the war. A leaked intelligence ministry document in October revealed plans to drive Gaza's population into tent camps in Egypt's Sinai Desert. More recently, Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich called for the voluntary migration of the Gaza population to the countries of the world. The imperialist endorsement of methods of warfare not seen since the Nazis can only be understood in the context of a rapidly developing Third World War. Israel's imperialist-backed onslaught on Gaza is part of a Middle East front incited above all by Washington with the aim of retaining its regional hegemony. The Biden administration has deployed 2 aircraft carrier battle groups and a nuclear-capable submarine to the region to prepare for military conflict with Iran. At the same time, Washington continues its backing for the far-right Ukrainian regime in the U.S. NATO war on Russia, which is aimed at subjugating the country to the status of a semi-colony and plundering its natural resources. In the Asia-Pacific, regular provocations by American imperialism and its regional allies against China continue. The callous indifference shown by Biden, Germany's Scholz, France's Macron, and Britain's Sunak to the deaths of over 14,000 Palestinians underscores that in this new redivision of the world between the major powers that is well underway, human life is cheap and expendable. The only way to stop the genocide in Gaza is through the development of a global anti-war movement led by the working class. The demonstrations involving millions of people around the world over the past 6 weeks have shown that there exists widespread disgust and outrage in every country over Israel's savage onslaught and the support it has received from the imperialist powers. What is required is a decisive turn to the working class, which must be mobilized in struggle to halt military operations in Gaza and throughout the region. Military supplies to Israel should be blocked, and the production of military equipment and other critical products must be halted through the active intervention of workers into political life. Preparations should be made for a political general strike on an international scale in opposition to the imperialist powers backing the Israeli regime, who are themselves deeply despised because of decades of attacks on workers' wages and conditions and the conducting of bloody wars. The success of the struggle depends above all on the development of a mass movement of workers fighting for a socialist and internationalist program. Rural Minnesota postal workers protest Amazon-USPS agreement forcing high workloads, by Matt Rigel. On November 13th and 14th, postal workers in the town of Bemidji, Minnesota, held informational pickets against overwork from a service agreement between the United States Postal Service, or USPS, and Amazon. Rural mail carriers stood outside of the Bemidji post office in the pre-dawn hours to demand additional staff to manage their workloads and better pay to make up for real wage cuts. Dennis Nelson, a veteran postal worker, told the local Bemidji Pioneer, quote, "Mail isn't being delivered on many routes because we're spending 12 hours a day just delivering Amazon packages. If you were to look in the post office right now, there's probably five or six routes where mail wasn't delivered yesterday because the packages had to go out," unquote. The agreement between Amazon and USPS, implemented in early November, prioritizes Amazon package delivery over regular mail. Already facing a staffing shortage, the letter carriers are now working extended hours, 12-hour days, 6 days a week, with effectively no overtime pay. Rural routes are not paid hourly, but rather through a type of piece rate system known as the Rural Route Evaluated Compensation System, or RECS. When implemented earlier this year, it resulted in massive pay cuts for the vast majority of rural carriers, in some cases of more than $20,000 a year. In addition, the additional workload from Amazon deliveries has led to delays in regular mail delivery, both workers and residents have said, impacting the distribution of essential items like legal documents and bills. The implementation of the Amazon agreement, which initially started in larger cities, has been problematic in other locations too, with high staff turnover and unmet demands for additional support. If the agreement with Amazon does instruct carriers to prioritize the corporate behemoth's deliveries, it would represent a violation of federal law, which stipulates that the Postal Service shall not, quote, "make any undue or unreasonable discrimination among users of the mails, nor grant any undue or unreasonable preferences to any user of the mails," unquote. In an anonymous post made on Facebook, a Bemidji postal worker described how the agreement has produced long hours and extreme working conditions, preventing them from doing their job. The worker wrote, quote, "A little over a week ago, the post office in Bemidji took over from UPS the delivery of Amazon packages. With our own workload, an average of almost 600 mailbox deliveries a day, combined with the Amazon deliveries, we are now being forced to work 12 hours a day, and all our days off have been rescinded by order of our district manager. We were already at a critical low staffing level before the Amazon deliveries, and we have lost several hard-working carriers over this issue. We now have several mail routes with no bodies to deliver them. District management has informed us that Amazon packages take priority, and no matter how long it takes, every package will get delivered daily. This is gross incompetence by management. Neither the equipment nor personnel were in place to be able to effectively perform this mission," unquote. Pointing to the widespread staffing shortages at USPS, another postal worker in Minneapolis commented, quote, "I'm a mail carrier in the Nokomis neighborhood of Minneapolis, and we are short-staffed there as well. They have not even attempted to get us help for Christmas, and packages take priority, so many routes will go undelivered the closer the holidays get and the worse the weather gets," unquote. A growing number of post offices and cities throughout the U.S. have been subjected to USPS's service agreement with Amazon, which workers routinely indicate adds a crushing workload. The protest in rural Minnesota is part of a growing wave of opposition among both postal workers and broader sections of the working class internationally, as workers seek to combat eroding wages and increasingly egregious working conditions and hours. Anger among rural letter carriers has been fueled by the newly implemented Rural Route Evaluation Compensation System, the RRECS. The RRECS is part of a vast restructuring plan supported by both the Democratic and Republican parties, which have the ultimate goal of transforming USPS into a privately run logistics company like Amazon, UPS, and FedEx. This is being carried out with the full collaboration of the main postal unions, including the National Association of Letter Carriers and the American Postal Workers Union, which have not lifted a finger to defend postal workers. Postal workers are determined to fight the conditions they face, but they require organizations under their control in order to succeed. The USPS Workers' Rank and File Committee is working to link up workers throughout the postal system so that they can share information and coordinate their struggles. Make your voice heard. Tell us about conditions in your workplace. All submissions will be kept anonymous. Contact us via the WSWS. U.S. Appeals Court Guts Voting Rights Act by Barry Gray. On Monday, the U.S. Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld a lower court ruling that effectively turns the landmark Voting Rights Act, or VRA, of 1965 into a dead letter. In a 2-1 ruling, the appeals court, based in St. Louis and overseeing the mid-U.S. states of Minnesota, Iowa, North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Missouri, and Arkansas, agreed with a U.S. district judge in Arkansas that private individuals and groups, such as the NAACP, had no right under the law's Section 2 enforcement provisions to bring legal challenges against redistricting decisions and other actions by states or localities that weaken the voting power of blacks or other minorities. The ruling currently applies only to the 7 states in the appeals court's jurisdiction, and is virtually certain to be appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Earlier this month, the conservative Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, based in New Orleans, issued a conflicting ruling on the same issue, affirming the right of individuals to bring such actions under Section 2 of the VRA. If the U.S. Supreme Court allows the Eighth Circuit ruling to stand, the evisceration of enforcement of the VRA will become the law of the land. In an extraordinary rejection of decades-long legal precedent and practice under the VRA and the expressed intent of Congress, U.S. District Judge Lee Rudofsky in Eastern Arkansas, a Trump appointee in February 2022, dismissed a lawsuit brought by the Arkansas NAACP and the Arkansas Public Policy Panel, challenging Arkansas's new legislative map. Judge Rudofsky threw out the suit on the grounds that any such legal challenge had to be brought or joined by the U.S. Justice Department. The judge argued there was no language in the text of Section 2 that explicitly grants private right of action under the VRA. In upholding the ruling in Arkansas NAACP v. Arkansas, Eighth Circuit Appeals Court Judge David Strass, another Trump appointee and author of the majority decision, acknowledged that he was overturning what has been settled law for nearly 50 years. He noted that over the past 40 years, only 15 of 182 successful Section 2 cases have been brought solely by the U.S. Attorney General. He wrote further that while courts have, quote, for much of the last half century, unquote, assumed that private individuals and groups could sue to enforce the VRA, quote, a deeper look has revealed that this assumption rests on flimsy footing, unquote. Strass was joined by Judge Raymond Grunder, a George W. Bush appointee. In his dissent, Eighth Circuit Chief Judge Levinsky Smith, also a George W. Bush appointee, wrote that, quote, while admittedly the court has never directly addressed the existence of a private right of action under Article 2, unquote, the court has, quote, repeatedly considered such cases, held that private rights of action exist under other sections of the VRA, and concluded in other VRA cases that a private right of action exists under Article 2. He continued, quote, until the court rules or Congress amends the statute, I would follow existing precedent that permits citizens to seek a judicial remedy. Rights so foundational to self-government and citizenship should not depend solely on the discretion or availability of the government's agents for protection, unquote. Many legal experts immediately blasted the Eighth Circuit ruling, decrying not only its substantive anti-democratic significance for voting rights, but also its radical judicial authoritarianism and contempt both for precedent and the intent of Congress in adopting the VRA. Paul Smith, senior vice president of the Campaign Legal Center, said, quote, "Eliminating individual people's right to sue under Section 2 of the VRA runs contrary to settled law, common sense, and any basic concept of fairness. When the government discriminates against people, they should have a right to fight back in court," unquote. Richard L. Hassan, professor of law and political science at the University of California, in a post on the Election Law blog, wrote that the Eighth Circuit majority decision was based on, quote, "a wooden textual analysis," unquote, despite, quote, "recognizing that the Supreme Court and lower courts have for decades allowed such cases to be brought, assuming that Congress intended to allow such suits," unquote. Hassan added that the appeals court majority, quote, "acknowledges that the legislative history of the passage of Section 2 leaves no doubt Congress intended to allow private plaintiffs to bring suit," unquote. Wendy Weiser, director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, said the appeals court ruling, if allowed to stand, would be, quote, "devastating to the enforcement of the Voting Rights Act," unquote. She added the decision suggested that there exists, quote, "an environment where judges felt like it would be permissible for them to rewrite the law and upend precedent and core rights and protections," unquote. Should the U.S. Supreme Court uphold the Eighth Circuit ruling, it would mark a major escalation in a mounting political and juridical assault on democratic rights in the U.S. that has been underway for decades. It would bring to mind rulings that paved the way for the American Civil War, such as the 1857 Dred Scott decision, which blew apart all legislative attempts to contain the spread of slavery to the new states being carved out of U.S. territories, place any restrictions on the institution of chattel slavery, or allow for the possibility of freed slaves becoming U.S. citizens. The current radical right court has already struck down Roe v. Wade, abolishing at a stroke the constitutional right of women to obtain an abortion. It has also struck down a partial student debt relief program passed by Congress and bolstered the quote-unquote right of religious zealots to deny service to individuals based on their religious beliefs. It is serving as a spearhead of a legal counter-revolution being directed by the capitalist ruling class, which is mired in crisis, facing a growing rebellion by the working class, prosecuting a global policy of imperialist war, and turning ever more openly to authoritarian and fascistic methods of rule. In 2000, the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 vote, handed the presidency to the loser of the popular vote, George W. Bush, by halting the counting of votes in Florida. That ushered in the War on Terror, the Department of Homeland Security, the institutionalization of drone assassinations, detention without trial and torture at places like Guantanamo. 13 years later, the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 ruling, Shelby County v. Holder, overturned Section 4 of the VRA, the pre-clearance provision that required states with a history of Jim Crow segregation and anti-black voter suppression to pre-clear with the U.S. Justice Department any changes in voting procedures. It marked a major escalation in the attack on voting rights, not just for blacks, but for the working class as a whole, including the imposition of voter ID requirements and other obstacles to ballot access for workers and poor people. Now, with the Eighth Circuit ruling, a new stage in the assault on the VRA and democratic rights has more broadly been initiated. It is possible, for tactical reasons, that the Supreme Court could either reject or modify the ruling if and when it hears an appeal. Last June, the court ruled in a Section 2 case that Alabama had drawn a racially discriminatory congressional map and ordered that the map be redrawn. But any such ruling in an appeal of Monday's Eighth Circuit decision would not mark a reversal of the capitalist court system's intensifying assault on democratic rights. Recent developments, in fact, point to a drive by at least a section of the far-right faction on the high court to complete the evisceration of the VRA. In a 2021 Section 2 case, Brnovich v. Democratic National Committee, the six right-wing Republican justices on the Supreme Court joined in a 6-3 decision upholding Arizona laws barring trade unions and advocacy groups from collecting voters' mail-in ballots and banning out-of-precinct voting. The ruling, coming after Donald Trump's attempt to overthrow the 2020 presidential election on the bogus grounds that mail-in ballots and other measures designed to facilitate access to the ballot during the pandemic were used to steal the election for Joe Biden, signaled that the right-wing court majority would make it more difficult to successfully challenge new restrictive election laws passed by Republican-led state legislatures following Trump's failed coup. This was made possible by the efforts of the Biden administration and the Democratic Party to conceal from the American people the complicity of large sections of the military and national security state apparatus, as well as major factions of the financial aristocracy and the bulk of the Republican Party officialdom, in Trump's attempted coup. Justice Neil Gorsuch, a Trump appointee, filed a one-paragraph concurring opinion to Justice Samuel Alito's majority decision in Brnovich v. Democratic National Committee, in which Gorsuch, quote, flagged one thing, unquote, the fact that the court had not directly addressed whether private individuals or groups could bring legal actions under the VRA against voting-related policies of state and local authorities. Gorsuch thereby signaled his support for the court to reconsider its practice since the passage of the VRA in 1965 of accepting such legal challenges for review. Far-right Justice Clarence Thomas, notorious for his corrupt relations with billionaire fascistic Republicans, signed on to Gorsuch's opinion. This has been Paul Fuller for the World Socialist Website.
The World Socialist Website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist Website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.